Well, I'm very happy today to have John Mouse on the show. John, it's an honor. You're a living legend.
No, you're the legend.
And I've been a fan of you. I think I started listening to you in 2008.
So before Pitiless.
Yeah, definitely before Pitiless.
You're a OG.
OG fan. I have pulled up your dissertation. I have theses on punk rock, which I had to use archive.org to surface.
Yeah, yeah.
To resurface.
Found it online, huh?
Your 15, what is this? Your 15 suppositions.
I don't know. Maybe is that, I don't know that. 15 suppositions. What's that?
This is maybe 15 something. Suppositions from John Mouse on art, music, blowing up cities on film, and Ariel Pink in the Los Angeles Times from July 15th, 2011.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And you were described as a synth punk artist.
Yeah. Well, you know.
And a thinking man's musician.
All right. That's great.
Spouting off theory.
Yeah. No. A lot of people just thought I was an asshole when I did that. You know what I mean? And then I kind of cowered it out. I'm like, maybe they're right. Maybe they're right. No,
when you did what?
No, just, you know, trying to bring some of that into the discourse around the music. You know what I mean? I don't know. But yeah.
No, I thought it was incredible. I remember being, I think I was literally at Occupy, and that interview with, what was it, like the drone or something came out, where you were like going off about Deleuze and the need to like intensify the use of a popular language.
Yeah.
And you were just like pacing around behind the venue. And I remember showing that to people, and we were all like, this is incredible. This is the real movement, like moving in culture.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely, you know, where I'm coming from, you know, or I have come from, you know.
Because you've been doing this for like 25 years at this point. I mean, you started what, in the late 90s, early 2000s when you started
your EPs? Yeah, so the first stuff I, you know, that's out there that I recorded would have been like 2000. The first album that released was 2005. But that's the whole thing. We were doing music between, you know, 1999 and 2005, just, you know, totally in obscurity. No mechanisms available to us to share it with people. So there's a whole micro history there between, you know, 99 and 2005, where we're just making albums that we never knew for sure anybody would ever hear or whatever, you know.
The utopian period.
Yeah.
Just doing it for the friendship and for the love. I remember there was this thing you said, I can't remember if it was in 2011 or after, where you were talking about the mistakes that you had made in the 2000s. And you were like, I was trying to push pop to be as poppy as possible, and it was so stupid and blah, blah, blah. Could you just talk about like the arc of your career? Because I feel like having seen your show recently in Milan, which was incredible, and we'll talk about in a minute in detail if you want, I saw a lot of continuity through the body of work. You know?
Well, yeah.
Or was
that
just what you were choosing to perform? Was the stuff that you like from that period?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of like an arc, I guess, you know, and we could talk about, you know, we're talking about the theory that that guided it and that sort of thing. When I in school, in like 2003 or 2002, whatever it would have been, Alain Badiou came and gave the paper on the 15 Theses of Contemporary Art. My professor at the time, Michael Pissarro, who's an experimental composer, invited him there. And, so he's given these theses like, art can only exist from the standpoint that from which it doesn't exist from empire standpoint, or since, or where the title of the album comes from, like, since it's so sure of its ability to control the domain of the visible and sensible via the laws governing, commercial circulation, empire no longer censures anything. All art and all thought is ruined when we accept this permission to consume, to communicate, and to enjoy. We must become the pitiless censors of ourselves. Theses like that were like a call to arms. It was like a crystallization of a Cartesian crystallization of the suspicions I already had, and I was working with. It was like a raising of the banner. So, and then Pissarro kind of elaborated on Badiou's theses. He had his own theses where a way we can think about the disparate musics, you know, of the 20th century, like Schoenberg and his circle, Cage and his circle, jazz from Armstrong to Coltrane, and punk rock or rock and roll or pop or whatever you want to call it, post-war popular music. I never know what to call it, what the proper name is, but that each of these are disparate truth procedures, you know, because I was struggling to square that circle. I'd already read Adorno's essays on popular music, probably, and that it was fascist and so on. This was a way to think about it, because on the one hand, I was performing and studying these experimental pieces like Lamont Young and Cage and Feldman, and on the other hand, Ariel's recording the doldrums in the room next to me. So how do I reconcile these two trajectories? And this Pissarro's, you know, teasing out from Badiou that it's just different musical truths with different groups of subjects kind of solved this for me philosophically. But at the same time, you know, Adorno's critique of the whole post-war pop or whatever you want to call it was always there too. But you know, but he has stuff like he calls to arms. He never fully recognized the positive possibilities in that music. Maybe for the same reason he missed the political possibilities of 68. But the resources, you know, necessarily to articulate it are there in his work. I think, like, you know, Kitsch only forfeits its right to exist when it mimics the verdicts of history and finds itself forbidden to reverse them. So, you know, there's a tension between those two guys you know, like in the theses on contemporary art, Badiou rejects the contemporary art's obsession with finitude and cruelty and death and suffering. But at the same time, you know, that might be, you know, dissonance is the area most productive of non-identity, the non-identity, which is the subjective expression of the objective, which is truth content in Adorno's aesthetic theory. I think it's safe to say that, you know, between the tension of those two, I kind of, especially with the live shows, landed on the side of Adorno's suspicions. Then later on, when I got to the dissertation, maybe like, you know, whatever it was, 7 years later, I got into Friedrich Kittler, the German media theorist. I deal with him a lot in my dissertation. And his thesis is that, you know, this music, rock music, punk music, is a misuse of World War II technology. These are all military technologies designed for warfare, which were repurposed. So play to the powers that be their own melody. This idea of positive feedback, of mobilizing the mechanisms of creating oscillations or positive feedback in the mechanisms of control you know, sort of amplifying their contradictions or something like that. All that stuff was designed, you know, for like radar and submarine detection. And so I thought that was an interesting idea. But so, you know, getting into that, like Kittler himself, I built a bunch of analog synths and all that stuff. But
wait, pause on the synths, because this is an interesting. We're going to go down a little synth side path here, because you're talking about this feedback and this like repurposing of the technology and everything. And as you were talking just now, I was imagining in my head those like West Coast synths where the oscillators, you like plug them into each other and then they're like modulating.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
LFO is just like going on its own thing. And I've even seen some people build these synths where like they almost like play itself, like you put some input.
Yeah,
but then the machine is just kind of freaking out in front of you. What do you think about that?
That's a whole scene that I don't know that well. The Dawless scene or the modular scene. But yeah, yeah. I mean, it's I there's, you know, I'm behind it, you know. I mean,
I think there is some creativity in there's like a, I don't know if it's true, all of the theories that you've been, you know, expounding about the, like, sort of detournement of war technology.
Right. Yeah.
But it sounds true to me in the sense of, like, Catch-22 is kind of like that. But instead of being about technology, it's like the experience of being in the war mobilization, detourned, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
There's something about that, that mass experience fracturing in the 60s and 70s that kind of ground so much contemporary culture in a weird way.
I don't know if it's an idea that, as far as I know, contemporary thinkers have struggled, like Agamben's stuff on De Bord, for example. He gives the positive possibility opened up by the alienation of language into spectacular relations, this sort of thing, like that for the first time, because, you know, communities no longer grounded on the presupposition of some sort of transcendental or whatever, it becomes possible to see how it really stands or something like that. But, you know, I don't know. Is that just nonsense or what do you think?
Well, I remember in your thesis on punk rock, if we can go to footnote number 22,
yeah,
the whole class,
yeah,
the subject of punk rock never sings like a baby. Punk rock is not a mobile for dazzling babies to sleep. For me, I feel like that's part of your work, that there was this like cutting edge in your music that was very distinctive of like the Combine, right? Like,
yeah,
the video,
yeah,
for the Combine is insane. Do you know what,
yeah,
I mean? Like, the Combine, it,
the video,
what'd
did
you say?
But the video got away from me, but yeah, yeah, I'm glad that you know, there's an encounter with a limit there when you listen to it, because that's obviously, it wouldn't be worth doing if I wasn't, you know, in my opinion, if I wasn't, you know, if that isn't precisely what I was trying to get at. But that, yeah, that, I mean, however you want to articulate it, as a truth or as a determined irreconcilability with the world as it stands, that's the point. In other words, I don't think you can dismiss it all as just, you know, from Little Richard or whoever, for Johnny Rotten, you know, you can't just, it's not just an ideological, you know, reinforcement of the world as it stands, in my opinion. There's something there. There's some truth there that resists the mechanisms of control. You know what I mean? But on the other hand, there is something the opposite of that. What high and low once critically signified, we still need to carry that forward, in my opinion. And because there is this whole crap where it's like cool today to be in the Mickey Mouse Club. Sing about Pepsi Cola. Like when I was coming up, that's what you were. That's what it was about overcoming. That's precisely what we were trying to imagine, something else than that, than everything you see is good. The Mickey Mouse Club, Henry. It's everybody just like, no, chill out. Why do you want to ruin the fun for everybody? The Mickey Mouse Club is fun. You know, and then you just sound like the old man yelling at the cloud, but
I think this is something that's happened across the board with, you know, I think the streaming era and the sort of, the rise of like the music as the, you know, the TikTok influencer. It's just like a different musical culture than, you know, Hype Machine and Pitchfork or whatever.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
Yeah. Or even, you know, 20 years before that with zines and punk rock and that sort of thing. You know what I mean? Like, but you know, it's just returning to the arc. You mentioned then I felt kind of exhausted with it. And what was I even doing? Like that sort of thing. In the end, it is just a mess because, I mean, maybe a way of talking about it is a truth, whatever the truth of punk, is not the truth. You know, so in that sense, you know, I'll regret, you know, to some extent, wasting my youth on fidelity to a truth at expense to the extent that it was at the expense of fidelity to the truth, because they're not always the same.
And if you wasted your youth, I'm going to have hell to pay for mine.
Up in your basement cooking drugs and lighting yourself on fire, or in a 4-ACO DMT snot cocoon talking to Paradelia, or divorced, or in seriously, you know, next to the dead body of your little brother. Because from the standpoint of Badu's ethics, where a thing is either good or evil to the extent that it marks fidelity to the truth, anything is fair game. Rimbaud's systematic derangements of the senses, fair game. Pharmakeia, fair game. Bataille's limit experience, fair game. Foucault's leather dungeons, fair game. So wearied and burdened, you know, and ridden around like a donkey with a bit in my mouth by a trillion demons, you finally reach the point through grace of putting on the easy yoke, you know what I'm saying? And so rather than a truth, you live in fidelity to the truth, which is he who is, as I know you know, brother. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, of course. But I think this is something that's hit a lot of, you know, this is actually something that I went out and I asked people, you know, friends of mine. I was like, hey, I'm going to interview John Mouse for the show. I want to come back to this question in a minute with this question that somebody posed to me. But just to wrap on your sort of musical arc, you went through this COVID period and now you're coming out into, like, you're touring again. I thought your show in Milan was excellent. The place was packed. I know you have your way of feeling it. We can come back to the sort of changes in your life and everything. But in terms of the music, I feel like the music is I was listening to your shit when I was living in my car, right, driving around. You know what I mean? That music has been with me through some of the hard, you know, the hard times, the good times, whatever. And it also is one of these things where it hits with people. Like, you were talking about being an asshole about the theory and everything, and I want to kind of, like, address that. It influenced me to go and study philosophy. It would be remiss of me not to thank you and to encourage you. Like, I know you were telling me that you've got more coming out soon.
Yeah, I mean, it's in the works. It's it probably in 2025. You know, just keep your eyes open. I started working again the last year or so. So yeah, there ought to be something coming in 2025. Just got to keep your eyes peeled. Yeah,
I look forward to that. Do you want me to ask the question now?
Yeah.
Do you think the nostalgic element in hypnagogic pop led to the turn to the right?
That's a good question.
And for me, when I didn't respond this to the person at the time, but in my head I was like, I don't really think John's music is nostalgic, or is it even hypnagogic pop? But I guess the label is like the label of the genre isn't that interesting of a question. But I never really felt your music was nostalgic. I never saw you as somebody that turned to the right. Or am I wrong, John?
That's interesting about the nostalgic thing, because there is stuff now. Do you know this, like, vaporwave and stuff like that? Like,
oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where it very much is, don't you think? Like, some kind of... But yeah, I mean, you know, in the aesthetic theory, like Adorno's aesthetic theory.
Because you didn't,
yeah,
but
I
you
mean,
don't have nostalgia for like the pop music of like the 60s, 70s, and 80s, because you weren't listening to any of that.
No.
As a kid or whatever.
No. We could talk about nostalgia, but the in the sense that the remembering or whatever is always sort of creative, it's not actually, mimetically, bringing something from the past forward. It's like I'm trying to ramble here about the creative thing in memories, you know, like where you're creating something, maybe like
Bennington
that, but
doesn't seem to mean nostalgic. It's painful.
No.
And it has an element of memory, but it doesn't have that nostalgia of where like the pain is sweet. You know what I mean?
No. But whether or not that sort of thing, yeah, it could be that. I mean, I wouldn't. Hopefully, I'm not guilty of it. But it could be that this is a reactionary thing. The nostalgia. You know what I mean? It's always fascist or whatever. You know.
I don't know that it's always fascist. I just personally don't really enjoy nostalgia.
Yeah.
Because for me, like, a lot of things in the past are more pain than, like, the sweetness, you know?
Yeah.
And so, like, I don't need to go back. You know what I mean? I'm never thinking, like, man, 2005 or, like, you know what I mean? I'm just never thinking that. I don't know about you, but
no. I've never thought of it like that. I use, using analog synths in 2000 was. I mean, I could see how people would go, you're going back to the 80s and they used analog synths or whatever, but it was just instruments, you know. It wasn't. I wasn't thinking of it like that, you know.
Somebody in the comments is going to kill me because I'm going to name the wrong thing. But I think it was like the Roland 303 or 808 or whatever got popular because it failed. Like when it launched, they wanted it to like replace actual drummers.
Yeah, I mean,
and then people
were
like, no, this sucks.
That's exactly right.
Then it flooded into hip hop and everything because it failed and they were like selling it at a discount.
Yeah, I know what you're talking. The machine you're talking about was a FM synth machine. All the machines they made, were maybe that's not the right word. They were used for some other purpose than they were intended, you know. That's how acid or whatever is created and stuff like that. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
And I think when it comes to like the turn to the right, I mean, you have your own like personal spiritual journey, which we can talk about, but I don't consider, finding Jesus to be a turn to the right per se, obviously. And what maybe this person was referring to is like the Ariel Pink January 6th incident, which you can talk about if you want.
You know, the whole thing with that is extremely embarrassing. It was at the end of the lockdowns and Alex Moyer, this filmmaker, invited Ariel and I and my wife to come out to DC where she was filming her next doc to talk about scoring it. We're like, yeah, sure, that sounds fun. I didn't have any idea something was going to happen there. And so we went there. We were in the hotel, and she's like, something's going down and on at the Capitol. You want to go down there with us to get some shots? And my wife and I were like, sure. And we went down there with her and her cameraman and got some shots of people climbing on the wall.
Oh, you're cutting out.
And so my wife and I, we went down there, and we got shots with Alex of people climbing the wall, and we went back. And Ariel wasn't down there. Later that night, the news came in that a lady was shot inside, and people on Twitter started saying I was a supporter. I did speak out, but I posted like a papal encyclical with burning concern, mistakenly thinking, that the paragraphs condemning the exaltation and divinization of race and blood and nation were clear enough about where I stood in relation to all that, that spirit's about as far from true faith in God and the concept of life that faith upholds as one can get. And I even, tried responding individually to some DMs coming off Twitter, like, no, I don't support this shit. But looking back, it seems like I wasn't clear enough at all. I mean, the story totally got away from me. A lot of people still seem to think I support all that. Like, I was just dropped from some festival in New York City because the other artists didn't want to share a bill with a Nazi. So, like, what do you even do with that? Like, good. I wouldn't want that either. You know what I mean? So
I mean, you talked about you publicly posted, not posted, you were published, you know what I mean? Talking about being, quote, fascistically anti-fascist.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's.
So it's like,
that's how it got away from me, Henry, because I was pissed that anybody that's listened to my music or followed what I've said about it wouldn't give me the benefit of the doubt there in terms of what, and I should have been clearer looking back, but even though I did release that little thing, I should have done more maybe why would anybody suppose I was behind that,
Yeah, because I think what, like, you're talking about a moment ago with the sort of questioning hitting that low point with the looking for the singular truth versus the singular truth.
Yeah.
Some people are going to interpret that as the sine qua non of a kind of rightward shift. I think that's completely wrongheaded.
It's
right?
The opposite.
Because
it's always
it's
the opposite.
I
mean, yeah. Brother, you know that. It's always the opposite of that. Yes, yes, yes. Invariably. It's one of the great temptations of the thing. You know what I mean? To turn it into some sort of dominating, prideful, telling other people what to do sort of thing. But he came to call sinners among whom I am chief. Do you know what I'm saying? That's what I need to remember. Do you understand?
I think there's a kind of presumption also, like to get straight into the political philosophy side of it. there's this presumption that faith is something that was fine for a certain era and will like allow it for certain historical figures. And then in the contemporary period, it always takes this reactionary valence. And that's just simply not true. Like I recently published, I don't know if you saw the article I published in International about Jean Jaurès. And there's this really interesting thing, feature of Jaurès' thought, where he's an out-and-out moral idealist. People like Robespierre legitimately, like him or hate him or whatever, they legitimately believe like the rights of man are divinely revealed. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So I feel like this idea that believing in a kind of transcendence automatically means right is just a, it's just kind of dumb.
Yeah.
It's just ahistorical. You know what I mean?
It absolutely is. And it's implicit in all the, in all the, in all the critical theorists that I cut my teeth. I mean, whether you're talking about Benjamin and Adorno, like that, that all that matters is we view the situation from the standpoint of its redemption and the eschaton, like all its eschaton, all its untruth is visible only from that standpoint. And then that's covert, you know, that covert messianism in Agamben. And you know what I mean? Like it's there with the radicals too, you know?
Yeah, it's there. And I think it's also something that on a personal level, it's something that coincides with people's life of what you were just talking about a moment ago, like burnout or need to change, where like a lot of stuff happens. Like a lot of people become right wing as they get older. It's not a surprise. And it's part of the reasons they get like a mortgage and they have kids and they have pressures on them and they get money and they get like status. And then it's like, they're not kids in a basement making mixtapes for fun. They're like, they have something at stake in the world and they'd like to preserve it. So a more conservative mindset kind of, you know, emerges from that, right? I mean, I see it happen all the time. Like I work with people who are not, you know, rich, but they're not poor and they got theirs.
The whole mommy daddy freaking bourgeois like morality is as far from the thing as it gets, man. I know the two are in certain spaces are synonymous, but I mean, it should, that's what I'm saying. Maybe it doesn't go without saying, but from my standpoint, it should go without saying that the two things are not synonymous, you know, like truth, transcendence, and some relation to that, some fidelity to that, and reaction. You know what I mean? And especially not only reaction, you know, the cult of race and blood and in family and, you know what I mean? That sort of thing, you know?
All the stuff with like the Haitian immigrant hate in Ohio. I mean, I at one point, like, wasn't Vance or whoever just like openly admitting like
that they're making it up?
I forget exactly what he said, but like, yeah, we're lying, but it doesn't matter. Like,
yeah.
There's this, I think with real reactionaries, there's just a disregard for the truth.
Yep.
In the name of like power, right? It's just like a pure power fetish or fixation or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's no transcendent truth there. And it's obvious when you listen to them talk because they're like inverting everything that's in the gospel and they just use Christianity because it happens to be the like majority religion and where they live. It's just pure manipulation.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And you're right. I mean, it's not my understanding of he who is, you know, who works his omnipotence through weakness and brokenness and death on the cross. You know what I mean? Like where wisdom is expressed through folly and all these inversions. You know what I mean? I mean, that was always the, even before, there was more cooperation on my end and more but through grace, more fidelity on my end. I had some understanding that, it is in the faces of the proverbial orphans and widows that you know we see where it stands. You know what I mean?
Well, let's go. Let's run that back. So we talked about the arc of your music, and let's talk about the arc of your like thought and you know religion and philosophy and stuff. So you like grew up religious, or what was your sort of like the religious philosophical arc?
No. I mean, not really. I mean, just sort of the middle class duty sort of thing. You know what I mean? It didn't make any sense to me, and I thought it was silly. You know, and I was against it. But then when I got older, I don't know, the guys at the European graduate schoolers, they're like Zizek and stuff had already written The Puppet and the Dwarf. And you familiar with that?
Yeah. So you
all?
Were like in a sort of Christian atheist vibe.
Yeah. Yeah. The Simone Weil, like, you know.
Well, did you read the Tobes book?
Touches us with which who?
The Tobes book?
No, I don't know that one. I read the Badoo one on Paul.
Yeah. So you're reading about Christianity, but you're not necessarily believing in it.
You're reading Hegel and you're going, it is like some sort of limit. It's the absolute expressed in religious thinking. It's that sort of a candy ass, in my opinion, a version of things.
Like, I never have understood Hegel, you know. I was like in high school, I was like a Kierkegaard guy. But I never understood Hegel. And I still don't.
Yeah, but no. But Kierkegaard too. I mean, the religious is above the moral. You know, I mean, there's another example of how it isn't reducible to reaction. You know, I mean, in Kierkegaard's thought at least. So that's kind of the. And that spirit is still, ubiquitous in some circles. I see it all the time, you know, online and stuff. It, the one I'm relating here, you know, there's a Zizek Cornel West video. It's just very brief at the end. Cornell kind of rebukes him, you know, like around his whole, why have you forsaken me is the quintessence of the thing. And Vail got into that too. You know, it's the moment where God is abandoned by God and there's, you know, Christian atheism, right? You know, and it's like, no. I mean, you know, especially you get into sacraments and stuff like that. I mean, we must love him as if he's absent. I mean, it sounds cool. You know, I get it. But in my experience, at least, there's a level deeper than that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think that's the sort of... That's another issue with a sort of like engagement with Christianity. Ironically, of all of the sort of theorists who have engaged with it, my favorite is Foucault.
Yeah, I know. I haven't read the fourth.
The unpublished, the final volume.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's because he has that French Jesuitical training and approach where he just like reads the text very closely. And so it's actually highly clarifying because he's like a genius, right? And so he can read the text and explicate it, and you're like, oh, that's very interesting. But I think what a lot of these guys miss is that, like, from a more traditional, like, Orthodox or Catholic perspective, the like sort of terrifying thing is that God is very imminent and present. You know?
Yes, like, yes, very. That's right. That's exactly what
the main problem
to
people
out.
Tend to get. I mean, I don't know if this is your experience. It's definitely my experience of like, I'm like kind of looking sideways at going to take communion because I'm like, am I going to like profane the sacrament? Like, am I ready to go in the Holy of Holies really? You know?
And then, so, you know, the last several years where I'm trying to catch up on all this, and I don't speak Greek, I don't speak Latin. They started me in school, you know, like I'm talking about being an undergrad in 2002 reading Theodore Adorno. It's like, that's kind of clown shoes, you understand? Because I hadn't read, do you know what I mean? No, I don't like that.
My wife had the final, like, was the last generation to get the Soviet philosophy training, which you start from the ancient Greeks and move forward. And they even do like Chinese and other ancient, but like you start with the ancients. And you just move forward systematically, which I think really is the best way to do it.
You have to acknowledge that you grew up, you know, eating Domino's pizza and playing Nintendo games, like I'm listening to New Kids on the Block. Like, what I'm part of the German Bildung tradition. Like, it's a totally, utterly, non-existent universe from the standpoint of the situation that I'm but there's resonances and so on and so forth. So
as you were doing music, you were backfilling all this.
I'm trying to catch up with it, and then you get to the Vanguard guys who are steeped there, like you've had on Jordan Wood and stuff like that, where and that's what prompted this whole digression is like you know, dealing with this question we just brought up about the, you know, whether Christian atheism or whether, you know, some sort of sacramental presence, you know, and then the creation is incarnation thing, where they're reading Maximus and like,
hell yeah,
you know, just, it's just like, I, that's what I mean, regrets. Like, where was this, you know, this is really philosophically interesting to me. And it's not afraid, like maybe, I'm just saying, maybe Agamben, definitely Adorno and Benjamin are afraid to name the name. It's like in the Theses on History, I think Benjamin says you got to be covert about the theology these days or something like that.
Yeah.
They're not. It's just, no, you name the name, you. And there's something refreshing and clean and exciting about that. You know?
Yeah, I enjoy it. Like and one of the things that was really liberating to me also was that, becoming Orthodox and everything, because there's so few dogmas and there's so much theology. Like there's so much theology. There's so much written. You can go back and like deep and wide. Yeah. You know,
I got Bulgakov and freaking who's the other guy? Florensky are on my list so hard. I can't wait. The passages I've seen from like Lamb of God and stuff. That's what I'm talking about. Like what meat.
One of my favorite Bulgakov books that I always tell people to read is Judas Iscariot, the Traitor Apostle.
I'm going to check it out.
Where Bulgakov basically questions like, are we right to condemn Judas so much in the liturgy, right? Which a lot of traditionalists would be like, oh, he's questioning how we treat him. Yeah. But like in the tradition, actually, like once you dive into the intellectual, like the theological tradition, you can just like swim around and do stuff. Like Isaac of Nineveh being like, justice has no role in the Christian faith and plays like was never mentioned in Christ's teaching. Do not say God is just because his justice is not demonstrated to you.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay,
yeah,
here we go.
Yeah.
And it's just like people just go there. And I think it's so freeing, especially like you were saying, when you hit this sort of rock bottom, we're like, and I don't mean that insultingly, like I hit that.
No,
you know
it's
mean?
True. Yeah.
You hit it, even if it's not that bad. Like I didn't hit rock bottom when I was living in my car and like struggling, like where am I going to, you know, park so I don't get fucked with, or you know what I mean? I hit rock bottom when I was like, I got married. Honestly,
same.
Getting married was me hitting my rock bottom because I was like, shit, I'm going to ruin this woman's life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, she's getting absorbed into all my messed up, blah, 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 blah. And that was what made me hit, you know, I wasn't like strung out on drugs.
But it's the best thing you've ever done, right? Or one of them at least, right? I mean, in the end.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, that hitting of the rock bottom of when you like call yourself into question,
yeah,
and you have that moment of like coming to faith. But just talk about that. Like, what was your sort of drive for this change? Because I assume you were like sex, drugs, and rock and roll for like, what, 15 years?
No, actually, I wasn't. It, that's the crazy thing. It was the work. That's what I'm saying. The work that that kind of led me into that. So I'm already 33 and I haven't touched any of that shit. You understand? Because it just wasn't in college. None of it. I mean, I had friends that did all that stuff, but it's like, no, I mean, it's part and parcel with the truth I'm involved with here. You know, I have to, I can't draw any more blood from the stone. Let's try systematic derangement.
It was a fully intellectual issue.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not in your philosophical, theoretical
work. With artists, I mean, I think that's true. I mean, whether it was jazz or I know Benjamin has his hash diaries, stuff like that. Like they like Baudelaire and all those guys. Like, yeah, you want to, but tie the limit, you know, maybe it will help the work. Maybe it will somehow help the work. I was a militant, Henry. It wasn't about soporific, cross-eyed escape from reality consciously. It was about maybe this will somehow, you know, because, and this is what I'm saying, you know, where some of this theory I was into gets goofy. It's like Blanchot talking in the space of literature about how the artist is going out into the place that is no longer secured by the default of the gods and this sort of thing. So it's just like everything is fair game. And I'm saying that's a fool's errand, because you just end up getting ridden around like a donkey with a bit in your mouth by a million trillion demons. You know what I'm saying? And and you reach that point.
And I've seen it firsthand. Like, I've seen this happen. Yeah. And it's one of my main critiques. And I had to go through a period where I basically dropped out of militancy and just, like, reflected for a couple years. That's actually part of what happened was during COVID. I was just forced. Like, I was in lockdown. So I was like, okay, I have time to think about things. And I came out being like, you know, maybe some of this post-situationist stuff is too crazy, actually.
Yeah. And that's precisely where you end up at that crossroads, at that cross. And you, at least in my case, you know, like you call on the name and you're saved, you know? I mean, that's my experience, you know? I mean, and I get, you know, the situation that we're in, as far as I know, you know, by and large, if we can say that, or in general, if we can say that, what we're talking about is silly and ridiculous and beneath contempt. And, you know, it's the whole Feuerbach, like, you know what I mean? All that stuff, or on a much lower level, even the guys DBH is against, you know what I mean? Like, they think we're clowns, you know, and we're talking about nonsense. But I mean, in my experience, it's the very opposite, you know?
No, I think it's really, this is like going to probably be one of my favorite episodes because we're going over so much like shared territory and so much shared experience. I think it's going to resonate with a lot of people. And I guess that to take it back to the music and to go back to your dissertation for a minute, I wanted to ask you about something specifically because you're one of the few people that I can talk Jean-Philippe Rameau with. So right, I wanted to ask you.
Yeah, yeah. I really got into it there. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, maybe I shouldn't have, you know, it was 2011, Pitiless had just come out. And, you know, if I was more prudent, maybe I would have focused on that instead of taking 3 years off to write a dissertation nobody would ever read, except for a few fans of my music who, you know, have, you know, God bless them, have no basis for that discourse. So it just kind of seems like clown shoes to them. You know what I mean?
Like, I don't like, honestly, John, can I give you a critique? Because before we started recording, John, just so the listeners know, critiqued me for not putting out enough podcasts. So yeah. I'm not going to critique John. Like, you should be more confident, man. Like, when you're saying everybody thought it was an asshole, or it's clown shoes. Hell no. Literally everybody, like, people back in the day thought it was legit.
Do they all think I'm a fascist now, though?
No.
Okay, like, okay, no, good,
people,
good, good.
People are like, yeah, there was that weird thing with the Capitol. What happened? And I explained it. Yeah. And hopefully this podcast will also, like, help, you know, people understand.
Yeah, yeah.
You can refer people to them, you know, to it when you need explanation. But the thing about, like, your confidence, I just feel like you're too negative about your own self, your self sort of estimation.
That's good. Thank you. Yeah. That's
you're just overly negative with yourself, which I would push back against. But to go back to Rameau, because in your dissertation, you're talking about basically this sort of like the relationship with music and technologies of control, right? And you talk about Rameau and his musical theories and Descartes and Newton and the sort of changes.
Yeah,
and that is all very interesting. But you didn't talk about something in your dissertation, which I want to ask you about.
What's that?
Are you familiar with the opera Buffa Platé?
No, I'm not. I to my great shame.
Okay, so in Platé, it was made for like the royal family for a wedding, uh-huh, right, at Versailles. And it's a kind of big joke because the poor princess that was getting married off is kind of, plain looking. And so he made this opera about this water nymph, this sort of like amphibian creature who in a sort of delirium attempts to seduce Zeus and like get Zeus to fall in love with her and, you know, convince him with potions and stuff like this. And at one point in this opera, there is a sort of fight between Folly, like the goddess of music or the muse of music, and the muse of like lyric or poetry, right? And the muse of music basically takes out this like dirge for Apollo and sings it as like a giddy, happy dance.
Right.
Right. And then switches to making it like very serious and, you know, dour and sober. Right. And demonstrates in the performance the superiority of music over poetry. That it's actually music which has the sort of reins over man in a way that words do not, because you can sing, you know, sad and despondent words in a happy way that makes people laugh and smile and whatever. And there was a quote from I forget who it was, one of these 19th century critics, who said that Rameau's popularity suffered because he, quote, took the wrong line on a most important point with his doctrine that for a musician of genius, all subjects are equally good. I want to know what you thought about that.
You painted the whole thing there. I think my brain is breaking down. What I think about that Rameau's failure was thinking that all subjects are equally good. Subjects in this case.
Like, basically the subject of the opera, of the music or whatever, doesn't matter. Like, he was kind of infamous for having not that great of librettos. But he doesn't care about the libretto.
Maybe I agree with him, though. Like words are the most unfortunate thing that ever happened to music. I agree with you that it's the music.
Think about Cocteau Twins. I always think about Cocteau Twins here. Like, their music will stand forever, probably.
I've never had a lyric bone in my body. I just say the mantra like over and over again. Like, it's comically.
I hate the Antichrist live in Milan, insane. Have you recorded that? Because I don't remember where that came from.
It came out and everybody was screaming. It will be on the next album. With Rameau, I was interested in like showing how it really was amazing how much the history of music theory exemplified the historical shifts I was trying to tease out, you know, and he was very much exemplary of the classical episteme Foucault outlines in the order of things, you know what I mean? In the ways that I spell out there. And then the 19th century guys very much exemplified theirs and so on up until today, which I don't know what's going on, but hopefully there's thinkers out there doing it.
And for the listener, I'll link to all these texts, by the way, so you can go back and read John's dissertation and all these other things.
Yeah, I mean, the chapters on method were bloated and wasn't very good. I mean, you know, it was uninspired, but that's...
Well, here you go with the self-critique, John. You're too critical.
That's the vanguard. I mean, now 10 years on from that, I mean, I do. It's like we were just talking about with your wife and her Soviet education. I don't speak Greek or Latin or German. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, what am I doing? Like,
but do you speak French, though?
Tiziana, a little bit. And then I've read Tiziana, Terra Nova, and Deleuze, and like Agam. You know what I mean? It's just like, it's clown shoes. And I, you know, it's clown shoes. But so is everything. Everything in this situation, you know, relative to the roots and the learning and the depth of the 19th century guys who, you know, of course, then, you know, paradoxically, with all that learning, culminate in, you know, the worst disaster of all. So, you know, I don't know.
I think some people overemphasize the Greek and Latin stuff. Like, I think knowing Greek and Latin is going to be important if you need to work on the primary documents in like an original way. But like, for example, I have I don't have it in here because it's still in a box. I just moved. But I have Bart Ehrman's translation of the Apostolic Fathers from Loeb. And it has like the Greek facing. And like a lot of people be like, oh, Bart Ehrman. What? Bart Ehrman knows his Greek, man. And that translation is great. And it helped me a huge, like that translation is hugely useful in my life. Because he opened that whole collection of ancient texts to me. Right?
Yeah.
So like for me, I just say like, I don't know, if you want to learn Greek, learn Greek. But I mean, if you just want to like read Plato, you can just get a good translation, just read it.
Yeah. That's true. That's true enough.
But what is like interesting you these days? Because we've talked about your arc and your development and everything. Like, so obviously you became Catholic.
I mean, the overlapping scenes that we're in. I mean, that's it. You know, I mean,
you become a Jordan Woodite.
I'm trying to catch up, you know.
Are you still bamboozled by the debate between DBH and Jordan Wood?
I haven't. I know they're having a beef, even though Wood was in
No, it's not a beef. There's a debate.
Wood's little spiel in the doc was nice, I thought. Did you watch that about how it's childlike? You know, it's not condescension. People mistake this childlike faith in goodness for. Did you watch that doc?
I have not seen a doc.
Yeah. So they're friends. That's cool that they're disagreeing. The young guy and the elder statesman have to freaking duke it out. That's cool. That's cool.
I think it's a very positive.
A lot of it's over my head. The universalism debate. I mean, I know it for you. It's not a debate, but you know all that stuff. It's really interesting.
It's evidence,
really,
John. What do you mean a debate? It's obvious.
Yeah. It's cool. I want to learn. I want to know more about it. But you know, you don't want to get too far up your own ass. You know what I'm saying with all that? Because the day to day, just trying to be nice to be kind and loving to the people around you, obviously is where it's really at. You know what I mean? If you're not doing that, who cares? If you have Maximus memorized, you know what I'm saying?
Well, there's a relative importance. I also think like one of the things I like to do for people is to give them permission to be intellectual, since we live in like an anti-intellectual culture.
Yeah. You know? What are you into right now?
John, you're asking me.
Yeah, I'm trying to catch up on the fathers and all that stuff.
The fathers is something that I always
and,
am just like,
and classical philosophy in general, man. I mean, like Neoplatonism, all that stuff. I read this Hassan Spiker guy on Kant and how the Muslim the theologians anticipated him and you know all this stuff. I don't know anything about it, you know. Like I'm trying to catch up, you know. And it's all there in seed, like covertly, and the stuff I did cut my seat on, which is like you know. The Adorno and the Benjamin and the Gammon and
the thing with the
Blanchot and Nancy and those guys, you know,
is that when you, if you want to lead like if you want to read Bajou and Agamben and all these guys, and you don't know the classical, I think it's like self limiting in a way. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like you got to go back and read Dialogues of Plato to get like a grapple with Badiou. You could maybe do like a first pass with Badiou and not have done that.
What is he doing then? Like, what is it from the standpoint of the history of philosophy, a book like Being an Event, which, you know, I was militantly behind when I was, 23 years old. It professes to overcome all previous ontology to be the true ontology. It professes to overcome Heidegger, to overcome Aristotle, to go where everybody being is multiple on a void. You know what I mean? There's no presence. There's no, I'm the most atheist ontology of all. Behold my greatness. You know what I mean? Isn't that kind of like hubristic or ridiculous?
It is hubristic. But what I'm saying is like, let's say you're you, right? You've read all of that. Like going to backfill with the ancients and then come back to it later could be productive.
Absolutely.
And I think that's okay for people to do, you know, because it's hard to do everything in order if you don't have, like my wife, a rigorous Soviet style education where they march you through forwards. But then it's the opposite problem. Like if you march forwards, you're going to need to go back to the beginning to put those early guys into question. You know what I mean?
Right.
But if you ask me what I'm reading, I'm actually doing a lot of political stuff right now. Like I'm reading.
Yeah, you mentioned to me you're into the 18th century revolutionaries now, right?
Yeah, I've been reading a lot in like Robespierre and Blanqui from 19th century, and like even modern contemporary stuff. Like I've been reading a lot in the sort of Italian left and with like the current French stuff. Like I'm reading a lot. Like I've been translating this thing about like AI and sort of like digital sovereignty and all this
stuff. That's a good one to talk about because AI, you know, like, so, you know, on the suspicion that he who would be an artist today must be in complete command of the most advanced means of artistic construction. I 5 years ago, I kind of got into that crap, the deep neural nets. I got into TensorFlow and trying to see as a kind of synthesis what that could do. And, you know, as a tool or whatever, it's kind of interesting. But the political thing to talk about here is the way people in our situation in general, if we can say that, talk about it is really wrong. the presuppositions that it, even you got to put AI in quotes, man. Like intelligence, yeah. Material things can't be intelligent. It's important we get our metaphysics right. That a lot of people seem to presuppose, you know, the pejorative Reddit thing computer could be intelligent. You know, that's insane to me. That's dangerous. That's a dangerous presupposition. If you're talking about it as if it's if it has an intellect, you know what I'm saying? DBH gets into this, and I forget which book where it the one before the last one, which is the dialogue, where he basically spells out everything he's going to do in that dialogue when he's critiquing the Anglo philosopher of mind, guys, which I know nothing about, but enough to know I wasn't interested in that.
That's one of my interventions I'm most proud of and happy about. Like, that's one of the few things I feel like I've intellectually contributed to the world is getting DBH to go on Acid Horizon and explain to everybody how AI is fake. Like, to me, that was like...
Yeah, no, that's the whole thing coming to DBH. I'm interested in when you came to him and your background and how, but for me, it's like, it's so preaching to the choir. I mean, in other words, the whole experience is just this, like, it's just like this, man, there's like a million people that are very influential right now that need to hear this. Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I don't need to hear this. I know this. I agree with you 100%.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? These clowns that are out there flapping their mouths as if they know something. And they'll never, it's just so insanely frustrating to me that the two shall never meet. You know what I'm saying? There's DBH and then there's the clowns out there flapping their prideful gums. And the collision that I absolutely need to see will not happen. Do you understand? And it's just the world continues to go on as it stands. I mean, it should be taken for granted. All those things that he's outlining there about the immortality and the immateriality and transcendence of the intellect and being. I mean, how did we? It's just how we got to the point where the whole question of being. I can't see it. Like, it's.
So the thing with me and DBH is, I think I was going back because I had basically gone from the ancients, done like the great books. Like, I had somebody gave me all of the great courses, philosophy, history of philosophy.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? So I was listening Charlton Heston read to me Schopenhauer.
Yeah, no, I've actually listened to those particular ones that you're talking about, the Charlton Heston ones. They're great. They got the voice actor. I always hear that voice, I think, when I read Kierkegaard, the Kierkegaard voice. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. But I was literally digging holes in the middle of nowhere listening to Charlton Heston on
tape.
I was talking about Schopenhauer, right? Like, I was digging digging a well by hand. So anyway, so I was going through this thing where I was like broke, blah, 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 blah. And when I went to college, I studied philosophy. And coming out of it, I kind of did this thing where when I hit rock bottom, I called a lot of what we talked about earlier into question. The sort of atheist ontology and all this stuff into question, even though I'd never really been a convinced atheist. You know what I mean? I'd always believed in God, but I had like, I didn't have a good theological foundation. So long story short, I got this book, The Experience of God.
Yeah.
And I read that on my honeymoon and my wife like flipped out because like I was breaking down mentally.
Yeah.
I was like in the Basque country. I was in Donostia reading The Experience of God and like trying to go to the beach and relax and just talking to my wife about like the eternality and the, you know what I mean? The like relationship of spirit and form and matter.
Yeah.
And my wife is like, what happened to you? You know what I mean? But I eventually kind of stopped sweating and we, you know, went to Bilbao and you know what I mean? Everything was fine. And that was what got me on DBH. I think it was Experience of God and The Doors of the Sea. Did you read that one?
I haven't read. Is that the one about the tsunami?
About the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami and the problem of evil.
And
like those were things that also kind of pushed me towards orthodoxy because it was like, this guy has a really serious intellectual, like he has a theology that stands, right? That can like go toe-to-toe with Agamben and Badiou and all these guys and like make sense. It's not like hokey. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that sort of gave me permission to think like, maybe, because I never, like, I had attended an Orthodox service as part of like a religion class in college where we like visited the mosque and we studied. It was like a comparative religion thing.
Yeah.
But I had never gone to the church to like enter into the mystery.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah. And the divine liturgy is I mean, it's, you know, this side of heaven, you know what I mean? It's as sublime as a thing can get in my opinion. You know what I mean? I mean, you cry. I mean, you just the all earthly cares. Let's set aside all earthly cares. Like, I love all those hymns. You know what I mean? He's good. He's good. You know what I mean? Like, it's sublime stuff.
I was listening to the Rachmaninoff. I remember this very distinctly. Like, as a key part of my conversion was listening to the Rachmaninoff all night vigil recorded by the, what was it? Like,
the
all Soviet choir. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Very beautiful.
That just blew me away. And I was so blessed because nobody was giving me this pressure of like, John, if you die tonight. Because, you know, because like in evangelicalism, they put that pressure on you, man.
Yeah.
For me, DBH was key to like undoing that psychosis a little bit.
Right.
And then also being, you know, like I just said, having an intellectual basis for that, you know, that married to the faith, that's not corny, that's not hokey, that's not, because a lot of it's like bullshit, man. Like the Creation Museum stuff, they have like a lot of verbiage, you know what I mean? But it's all founded on just like nonsense.
Yeah. It's more important to go look for Noah's Ark than, you know what I mean? It's the same thing. It's more important to hate condoms than to talk about the incarnation or the, you know, it's crazy stuff. I mean, who has time for it, really? It's not what we're doing.
So what is going to change for you going forward? Because you went through this whole period, the death of your brother, pseudo cancellation.
Yeah.
I don't think you're actually canceled. The pseudo cancellation, the weird COVID period, coming back on tour, going through this conversion process. Because you've been Catholic for what, like 5 years now?
Well, I mean, I've been Catholic since I was a baby, but so I think
because you're basically settled into it now, like you've gone through all of that,
now,
right?
You know, and that's the middle age thing, and it isn't, you know, we put the caveat, the asterisk.
I met your wife is lovely. Shout out to Kiko.
Yeah. I mean, and
we seemed happy. You're giving me a front, but you all seemed very happy.
Like in the disaster, we were having problems, you know, but yeah, now it's been, you know, by grace, it's been peaceful for years. So I've settled back in. I'm working again, and it's in a different spirit. You know what I mean? So I'm left confused about what it is I'm supposed to do. Meaning, you know, like I said, I took 3 years off after Pitiless to go write a dissertation because I was thinking maybe I might teach. You know what I mean? Something like that. But it looks like the daily bread is going to come from doing shows and releasing music. So I'm committed to do that in a more straightforward way than I did, you know, in my 10 years ago. Do you know what I mean? I messed it up a lot because I wasn't thinking how one is supposed to think when they have attention and you're supposed to put something out every year and, you know, all that sort of thing. I always kind of kept it at arm's length and didn't fully, you know, commit to the responsibilities involved in having that sort of doing that sort of work. So now that
but that's also reflected in your writing from that time. Like when you talk about, you know, there are instances where the police (played on NPR, discussed in Pitchfork, sold at Starbucks, etc., close round of truth so as to put it to work.
Yeah.
Right. When you're talking about that, like it's clear that you had, and I assume you still have, a sort of internal conflict about like punk music.
As far as I know, it's all but completely abandoned as a parameter amongst people younger than me to think about things in those terms, which was us, you know, maybe in a certain way carrying forward this some sort of semblance of what high and low critically signified. Yeah, we're making idiotic pop music, but it's something else than the spectacle. Do you understand? We're not in the freaking Mickey Mouse Club. Do you understand? That's bad. To sell Pepsi Cola is bad. Like, why is that okay? Why is that? Why does no? It's just like, no, chill out. That's fine. They talk about the smiling toothpaste beauties as if that's it's somehow the vanguard. It's ridiculous. What we're doing is in radical antagonism with that. In how we do it, whether we do it.
You're going to eviscerate me when I publish my critical appreciation of Sabrina Carpenter.
I don't know that, but you know, it looks the same to a certain extent, but it's like maybe the difference between fast food and the real thing. But then again, I got in my mind bouncing around all the critiques of authenticity and how that, you know what I mean? So it's just schizophrenic, you know what I mean? Like, oh, there's no...
You do have a singular sound, though, and an approach that I don't know anybody that does or can pull off. Because, like, to put some meat on this, when I went to Milan, right, we're in this club, and it's packed. It's completely full house. You're up there totally solo with the mic and, like, pressing play on the computer or whatever to start the track, and then you're singing. And people were completely captivated, jumping, screaming, singing everything with you. Everybody was there was nobody that was like, oh, what is this, blah blah blah, wandering off.
That's how it was at the beginning. I had shit thrown at me, all that sort of stuff, you know, like, what is this clown doing up there, you know what I mean? And there's something about that too that is also, you know, confrontational or, you know, cool, but both. I mean, I prefer what you're talking about. Obviously, it's more.
But people love you, man. Like, when you came out and met the fans and everything, like, everybody was coming up, and there's such a real connection with.
That's so. It's so humbling, though. You know what I mean? Like, how do you even wrap your head around that? I mean, that's what it's about. Like, that's some indication, hopefully, that what you're doing is worthwhile and isn't futile, isn't purely futile.
No. Yeah,
you know what I mean? So it's a lot to reckon with, you know, like it's really amazing.
And does that bother you? Like, I guess what I wanted to ask with the music, does it bother you to go out on stage and do it solo like that? Do you want to rebuild a new group, or what is your kind of?
I don't know. I talked to people after, and some of them prefer the solo thing, you know, which, for lack of a better word, is more like performance art or something like that. Like, some people prefer that. Other people are like, nah, it's, you know, you got to have a band. It's better that way. In terms of the,
what do you like more, though?
To be honest with you, I don't like either. Do you understand? It's really, I mean, I'm not trying to be, you know, like I have to break rocks or something like that, and I don't like breaking rocks. It's mm-hmm. more like, it's horrifying.
It's hard
really,
either
really
way. There's a downside, positives, and negatives to both.
Yeah, that doesn't, from my standpoint, that doesn't make it any easier, whether there's other people with me or not. It's just, every time you're trying to do something worthwhile, you shit your pants a little bit, I think. You know what I mean?
Yep.
It's not cathartic. It's trying to fight. I mean, in my mind, at least, and maybe that's comical and only something that should be derided with contempt. But in my mind, at least, trying to bear witness to the. to the suffering or whatever, it's like trying to, you know, it's like doing a chin up, you know what I mean? Your legs shake, and it takes everything, you know, everything in you, you know what I mean? It breaks. If you're not at that limit, then you're not doing anything, at least in my mind. And it's comical. Like one of the reactions is that it's comical, you know, it's comical to see anybody in our situation attempt to do something with any sort of seriousness. You know what I mean? Like that looks ridiculous, you know. There's something about that dissonance that is interesting and provocative to me. You know what I mean?
Have you ever thought about doing sacred music?
Yeah, you know, concert music and sacred music would be really, really, really interesting things to get into. But maybe, you know, maybe I'll just do it on my own at some point. It would be cool to get, you know, just putting it out there, just like film music is something I've always wanted to do too. To get somebody to ask me to, but I could do it on my own too. The things I'm working on, you know, are just by default, I guess I wouldn't call them sacred because they're not for liturgical, situations, but that element hopefully is always there, even though it's secular.
Because I wonder about this, because it seems to me, based on what you're saying, if you allow me to pry, which maybe I shouldn't do, it seems like for you, you had a kind of situation musically where you had your band of brothers, you had your context that was very productive for you and you felt really positive about. And then that is post-COVID, you don't have that situation. And so you're trying to sort of rebuild a new situation, which I think is, that was my case during COVID. All my political situation I had to rebuild afterward. I still had friends or whatever. It's not like I had nobody, but it's in terms of my immediate, who's around me. After COVID, I'm looking around. I'm like, okay, I got my wife. Now I have a kid. How am I supposed to approach things now?
The channels available to me and are totally, unfortunately, totally unrelated to any of those channels, as far as I know. It's indie rock or whatever you call it. You know what I mean? Nowhere near the sacred music spaces or the concert music spaces. I don't even know what they're doing in those. I mean, I was involved with experimental music in college. It would be interesting, although, it would be very difficult to try to do some sort of music in either of those things. I went and studied chant a little bit with some monks nearby.
They, what kind
they
of chant?
Gave a course on the Latin,
like Gregorian.
Yeah. They're good. It's the Solemn method, and it's nobody knows exactly, how to interpret these neumes. So there's different schools about, and it's a good. It was they're in the States. They're the best, in my opinion, at it. These guys, and it's in that context, and it's. I've always thought the heart of Western harmony and so on is there in the chant repertoire. You know what I mean?
I think you're a genius and you could invent a whole new form. You could invent a whole new style of chant or whatever.
My suspicions have been that you have to begin from the proper, you have to begin from the conventional. The invention of new forms was a modernist 20th century. It was tied up with that. It's a different truth than, and it's always eternal, of course, but it's a different truth than the truth of the Marx and Coca-Cola kids. You know what I mean?
Of course.
Than the Super Mario Brothers.
Or think about, go back to Rameau. I mean, I think Rameau invented new forms of music without being a radical rupture. And that was actually what got him in trouble with guys like Rousseau, who is also, I enjoy Rousseau's music. I don't know if you like Rousseau or not.
Yeah.
I think the air of
They're
three notes
good.
Is divine,
Nietzsche's
right?
Good. All those guys are good. I mean, there's not much you can steal from that music in terms of our music, because it's so radically different in so many ways, whether it's the Gallant style, Rameau and Haydn and all those guys, or the Baroque or all that. But then there's, paradoxically, before major minor tonality really, really starts to, become the idiom, which is like the Renaissance, especially the early Renaissance and the medieval stuff. There is stuff in there that, cause it's a weird, cause they thought about harmony in a closer, in a way.
What's some of your favorite music from that period?
Well, I like Guillaume Michaud. I mean, I like the all that. I mean, it's crazy from our standpoint, harmonically, it's crazy. I've used it with Ariel and I did Ghosts. I mean, Panda Bear sampled it. That's it. Jasquin des Prés is another. Which When Love Letters from Hell is like a like I'm dealing with his harmonies, even Maniac, the harmonies that are successfully going by there are from a Josquin motet, I think, stuff like that. So I've always, that stuff has always, and then to hear it in its liturgical situation, which I finally did, like to hear two solus in a mass, it's just like this is it's at home, it's amazing. So all that stuff, yeah.
I think this is one of the reasons why guys like Arvo Pärt have such success, yeah, is because they're able to take these sacred forms, which do risk basically all these forms, like Renaissance music or early music or Baroque,
yeah,
or all these things that have been revived and played, yeah, have a risk of either becoming like weird Frankenstein's monster, where like, are you familiar with like harpsichord?
A little bit.
Building and stuff like that. There was this weird thing in the 20th century, like, hey, we should have harpsichords again. Because like the 19th century, they just dropped off.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? For piano. Yeah. And like, we should build them again. They were building them.
Renew music ensemble or early music ensembles wanting to do it correctly and stuff.
They were trying to do it. And in like the early 20th century, the harpsichords were being made of like metal. They're making harpsichords like pianos.
Yeah.
And then people were like, this isn't really right. We should we should find the old harpsichords. But there's this problem of like, to what degree are we going to go back and repeat and try to do like, one of those living museums where it's like, look how we turn the
butter.
That's
what it
is. You know what I mean?
For the most part, that's what it is in our situation. But then there's weirdos like you or like me. It's just like, it's something else than what it's supposed to be, the museum thing. You know what I mean? It lives.
This is something that maybe you actually have freedom in now because you're at like this middle-aged point. Like if you go back to Rameau and his career, I think he was basically starving, struggling, scrabbling until he was like 45 or 50, when he got like the king's favor and he could start doing more what he wanted. Or I actually over Christmas, I heard a Marc-Antoine Charpentier, like Baroque Christmas. And the reason he was doing sacred music is because Lou Lee was like dominating all of everything else. So he was just like relegated to the sacred, like
that's
niche,
That's interesting.
But like he found a way to be productive in it. And I think like, I don't know, I've been trying to gas you up a little bit because you've got this like overly negative self image or whatever. But like you're established like in like indie music or whatever.
Yeah,
alternative music.
I'm lucky.
You're established. You're a living legend.
I think
you can do what you want.
Will be good. I think it'll be good. I think new stuff is coming.
You can be weird, John.
No album is coming. And yeah, I get increasingly weird. I feel like I really tried to push it on screen memories, and then just nobody really wanted to hear that. You understand? Like, there's some sense with pop that you take a song like Day in the Life as a famous example or something like that, or Good Vibrations or whatever. Like, no, that's not a good example because it's too catchy. But these with symphonic ambitions from a pop standpoint or something, like maybe that's alien to pop. Maybe that's, but it's not, because those are classic songs and they're, So negotiating that antagonism, it's really,
why do you think people didn't want screen memories?
I don't know. I don't, in terms of reception, I feel like it was a fail. That's maybe unhumble. It's crap anyway. I don't know. But like, from my perspective, it was like, whatever I thought I did there, it didn't seem to me anybody's like, oh, you did what you thought you did there. You know what I mean? Like just building all these freaking synthesizers, like, okay, now I'm going to do this 4-point counterpoint. And like, you know what I mean? Now I'm going to freaking, you know what I mean? Like I'm going to record my brain waves with an EEG. You know what I mean? Like all this stuff, just totally, totally be at the limit of the thing. That's what I thought.
You're full of shit, dude. I just looked up the screen memories. Okay, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 magazines or whatever publications. Some of them are pretty well known, like Le Zinrock in France is like a major thing, Fact, like people know about that or whatever. And people are like, best 2017's best album. I don't know why you feel
that
like
was
people
best
didn't like
album.
It.
I didn't. How did I miss that?
You have albums of the year 2017, top 100 albums 2017, top 50 albums
that.
Of 2017, albums
that.
Of 2017, best
but
of music 2017.
Is, think about it. It was right before 2016. So, and it was right before COVID and all that. The apocalyptic thing. I mean, all art should be apocalyptic, right? Like it's got to unveil. It's got to.
Pitchfork gave it an 8 out of 10. What are you talking about? What do you want? A 10 out of 10?
Did you hear me quoting a church in a kingdom in Pets? At the end of Pets, I'm
Yes.
doing the yeah. So, you know, you gotta it did it was it was it, it did it rec was recognizing the eschaton, you know what I mean? Like, that's what I
You
mean.
look, here's what it is, John. You want to cut the shit. You have Pitiless Censors in 2011. Then you did the Rarities compilation. Then you
Yeah.
didn't do anything. You didn't release anything for 5 years.
Yeah, because I was doing
Like,
a
that's all it is.
dissertation. I did it, but that's what I mean. Like, what's different now? I think I'll be more. I think I'll try to keep more to a
More
yearly thing.
consistency.
Yeah. Because, you know, I mean, there's not a teaching gig ever on the horizon, stuff like that. So this is the bread and butter. This is what I'm doing. I was ambivalent about that 10 years ago. Like, you know, do you really want? Because I don't know what I was thinking. It was too much on the side of any sort of earning your bread and butter with this is already compromised. Like, that suspicion, like I misguided
No, I think
suspicion.
you gotta. I think you gotta liberate yourself from that a little
Yeah,
bit
yeah, yeah,
because the
yeah.
thing, the end of the day is
Because you
like
don't want to be Mickey
you.
Mouse Club shit. You know what I
But
mean?
you don't
That's
have to be Mickey
no, I
Mouse
know,
Club.
I
Like,
know, I know, I
what do I
know.
want? Okay, now I'll be selfish. What do I want from John Mouse? I want you to keep touring
I'm
so I
going
can hang
to.
out with you again. I
I'm
want you to
going
come back
to.
to Europe so we can
We're
hang
going
out.
to. We're gonna hang.
And then I want you to like write, but you don't have to write a dissertation. You could write like 500 words. You know what I mean? You could like
Yeah.
write about your voice. You could write a travelogue. You know what I mean? But I think you got to get those. It seems to me that for you, the creative situation is very important in your sort of self conception or your vibe about your music.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like when you're telling me that the doing it with the group or doing it solo, it makes no difference for you.
Yeah.
That makes me feel like there's something deeper that you're looking, you know what I mean? You need
Yeah, that's
some deeper thing.
yeah. I mean, that's and it's true. I mean, it's
Did
true.
you feel inspired on tour or was it just like work?
No, it's I just
Because y'all were running crazy. I remember that
I
day you
just
came to
I
Milan. I
just
was
I
like, hey,
just
we're
I
going to
just
be there in 3 hours.
I just what I'm trying to do, it's not like a martyr thing. It's just it's difficult. You know what I mean? And I
Yeah.
don't mean like I'm not grateful for the opportunity, and I don't mean I don't count my blessings and that I know
No, but that's not what
people and
I'm
it's
asking.
available.
I'm asking,
But
do you feel inspired or is it like, let's put it in a really stupid way. Do you feel like you get more than you're giving in terms of energy or
no. If I
creativity or?
felt if I felt that, it would not be. It would be doing it for me, and that's not a reason to do anything. I if anything, I hope that that something takes place, you know, other than this the world the present evil age. You know what I'm saying, Henry? Like, I hope something
Yeah.
is taking place other than the place. I hope something is, and you can never be positive that's the case, but that's what I'm striving for, and it takes and that's ridiculous. Again, I understand that's ridiculous from a lot of standpoints, but that's I don't have any other basis from which to proceed. So that's how I go forward, and hopefully it ignites the hearts of others. You know what I mean?
I think it definitely does
Bears
ignite the hearts
witness
of
to the
others.
suffering and the untruth of our situation. You know what I mean?
But I mean, why do you think you're selling out a packed out thing in fucking Italy?
Yeah. No, it's good. It's good. I'm, yeah. I mean, yes. So yeah, I'm inspired. I'm inspired in that sense to do it. But you got to leave more on the field than you have. You know what I mean? Like,
I mean, when
that's what I'm saying.
you go out in the field and you hit, because you were running ragged.
Like,
Like I
you
was trying to say a
know,
minute ago.
here's the thing. Like, what I'm talking about is, like, you know, I've been around a lot in those situations a lot, and there's another vibe where it's like, who cares? Like, I'm just gonna I smoke dope and drink beer and go out and give the audience the finger and go backstage. Like, that attitude is at a, you know, I mean, caricatured in that way, assuming there's nothing else than that behind it. Is at the other extreme from what I hope I'm doing. You know what I'm saying? Like,
Yeah, of course.
that's what I'm trying to tease out, you know?
Yeah. But I guess what I want to see is like I want to come see you on the next tour and I want you to be not running as ragged because
No,
the
I'm
last
not.
tour was a little bit
I won't be.
nuts.
I won't do that again. That European thing, it was like 40 days in a row. like straight. I mean, it was a.
And you were going from like city to city, one after the other.
Yeah. And we got the plane every morning, and at 8, you know what I mean? Went, you get shitty, nervous at, but while you wait for it to start, it goes on at 10. You go, you talk, and you're out to midnight, and you go and go to sleep, get 6 hours, and go and do the thing the next day. Yeah. So that's what it was. So we were a little bit, my wife and I, who I wouldn't have been able to do it, obviously, without her help.
Shout out again to Kika. Yeah. We love Kika. Yeah.
So,
she was supporting you. She was moving things around. She was moving the albums and the, you know, she was getting everything organized. And I feel like, I think what I want to try to do, because I think coming out of, you know, it sounds weird coming out of COVID, but that was such a shattering experience for so many people's lives that
it was for mine.
I'm kind of at a, yeah,
and
of
then
course.
Especially with my, Kiki and I were having big problems then, and then my brother died, so it was really a bad time for me, like really bad. My uncle Larry, man, he was like a second father to me. It was all these things at once, and I had some vices, you know, and blah blah blah, and it just kind of, but you know, it precipitated in a redemption. You know what I mean? So I'm ready. I'm ready to go.
I think there's a point where we can start to build a kind of new intellectual, artistic, political situation or culture that moves in a positive direction.
Yeah.
And so hopefully there will be opportunities moving forward for those kind of like band of brothers type situations to reemerge and reorganize in the new context.
I know
a lot of people feel that way. It's not just like you or me, right? A lot of people are looking for that. So everybody, hold your breath. I'm looking through different chateaux as we speak. We might be able to get some people together in a chateau. But no, man, I appreciate you so much.
I appreciate you having me on, Henry. I know you mean, I mean, we've just in our online friendship, the whole, and then in real life, finally meeting and all that stuff. I mean, it's carried me through. I really appreciate it too.
And so we're going to have you come back on in the future to talk about your new projects, your new readings.
Yeah, anytime. We should get heads together and start and debate and, you know, do all that. Yeah. We got to occupy, you know, because in general, I feel like this space is filled with reaction, and it's good to try to step into it and articulate something else than that. You know what I mean? I mean, like online.